I now turn to the very difficult and even dangerous theme, the kind of love I call Eros, by which I don't mean sexual experience in general, but that special variety of it we call being in love. That the state of being in love is a specifically, though not universally, human variation of sexual experience, I don't propose to dispute. We must notice at once, however, that this statement is part of our reconstructed history of the universe, not necessarily a description of what all people feel to be happening when they fall in love. It may be what some feel. A man may, for all I know, sometimes first feel sexual desire for a woman, and then afterwards go on to fall in love with her. I suspect this is rather rare. It's what schoolboys imagine that falling in love will be like. Often, I believe more often, what goes on in consciousness is the reverse. What comes first is a delighted preoccupation with the beloved in her totality. It hasn't, so to speak, leisure to think of sex. She's primarily a person. Even the fact that she's a woman may seem for a while almost irrelevant. It's far more important that she's herself. If you asked a lover what he wanted, and if he knew himself well enough to speak the exact truth, I think he'd reply, "I want to go on thinking about her." He's a contemplative. And when, at a later stage, the explicitly sexual element awakes, he won't feel, unless scientific theories are influencing him, that this had all along been the root of the whole matter. Thus there's a certain opposition between our generalized historical picture and our experience. In the one, sex sprouts or flowers or develops into or elaborates and disguises itself as Eros. In the other, Eros takes over and reorganizes sex like an invader taking over and reorganizing the institutions of a conquered country. The nature of his reorganization is, I suppose, very generally understood. The only difficulty comes from the fact that wholly untransformed and wholly transformed sexuality don't occur in everyone's experience. There's a whole twilight of intermediate stages. In them, the subject may be deceived about his own condition. Under the influence of sentimental idealism, he may suppose himself nearer to the transformed condition than he really is. Under the influence of a doctrinaire cynicism or realism, he may make the opposite mistake. But the extremes in their, so to speak, chemical purity are not uncommon, and I'll concentrate on them for clarity's sake. Sexual desire without Eros wants it, the thing itself. And the thing, of course, to speak plainly, is a sensation located, like all sensations, within one's own body. There's no more unfortunate idiom than that which makes us say that a lustful man prowling the streets wants a woman. In a sense, that's exactly what he does not want. Or he wants her as he wants a packet of cigarettes or a bottle of wine. Wants, that is, the sensations he will have in smoking or drinking. Similarly, he wants a pleasure for which a woman is the necessary piece of apparatus. How much he wants the woman herself may be gauged by his attitude to her 5 minutes after fruition. One doesn't keep the packet after one smoked the cigarettes. Now, Eros does make it possible in the strictest sense to want a woman, not, of course, any woman, but this one. The lover, in some mysterious fashion, desires the beloved rather than the pleasure she can give. No one ever sought the embraces of the woman he loved as the result of a calculation that she would be more pleasurable than any other woman. Without Eros, this desire, like every other bodily desire, is primarily a fact about ourselves. Within Eros, it's about the beloved. It becomes almost a mode of perception and certainly a mode of expression, something outside us in the real world. Eros, though the father of pleasures, has usually the air at his height of regarding pleasure as a byproduct. Hence, in his realm, the miraculous combination of great desire with great ease in abstaining. And anyway, whose pleasure? The distinction of giving and receiving is here obliterated. Now, this whole talk would go astray if I didn't at once say with every possible emphasis that these distinctions are not intended to carry any moral valuation at all. The sinfulness or innocence of the act of love does not depend in the least on the presence or absence of Eros. Right and wrong turn on things far plainer and more prosaic than fine shades of feeling. This act, like any other, is to be justified by its conformity to the great rules, on the keeping or breaking of promises, on justice or injustice, on charity or selfishness. Thousands of generations of our ancestors were married off in early youth to partners chosen by their parents with whom they were not in love. Dozens of them were good people and kept their vows. The mutual duty of paying their marriage debt, as it was called, was discharged with no other ammunition than plain animal appetite, for no other was to be had, and they did right. On the other hand, this act, done under the influence of a soaring and iridescent eros, may yet be plain adultery, may involve breaking a wife's heart, deceiving a husband, betraying a friend, polluting hospitality, and abandoning one's children. Fine feelings don't mend the matter at all. In my distinctions between sexuality in general and eros, I have not been evaluating, but only trying to define. I now turn to questions which do involve good and evil. With mere sexuality, and all the sufferings and sins it has scrawled across human life, I'm not concerned. My subject is eros. But this subject itself forces us to make a distinction between eros in general and the explicitly or carnally sexual element within it. It's been widely held in the past, it's perhaps held by some unsophisticated people today, that the moral danger of eros derives chiefly from the carnal element, and that eros is in some sense best or noblest or purest when this is reduced to a minimum. Hence some of the older moral theologians seem to have thought that the thing chiefly to be guarded against in marriage was a soul-destroying surrender to the senses. Notice, however, that this is not the scriptural approach. St. Paul, dissuading us from marriage, says nothing at all about that side of the matter, except to discourage prolonged abstinence from the act of love. What he fears is preoccupation, the need of constantly pleasing, that is, considering, one's partner, the multiple distractions of domesticity. It's marriage itself, not the marriage bed, which will be likely to prevent us from waiting uninterruptedly on God. And surely St. Paul's right. If I may trust my own experience, it is, within marriage as without, the prudential and practical cares of this world, and even the smallest and most prosaic of those cares, which are the great distraction. My prayers have more often been hindered by petty anxieties and decisions about the conduct of the next hour or so than by any passion or appetite whatever. It seems to me clear that the medieval writers, themselves nearly all celibates, were unaware of the change eros works upon sexuality. Preoccupation with the beloved may indeed be an obstacle in the spiritual life, but not, I think, chiefly that kind of preoccupation. Nevertheless, the act of love, within eros, between lovers, is haunted, and especially in our time, by its proper danger. The problem is to regard it with the right kind and the right degree, no more, of seriousness. Of course, considered in relation to its possible consequences and to the marriage vow, it is as serious as any natural action could be. I'm not speaking of that. I'm speaking of it considered, as all lovers do and must consider it, in itself. Now, the act of love, Venus, as our ancestors called it, has even on those terms its own inherent kind of gravity, but it's also very possible to take it too seriously or with the wrong seriousness. And especially today. A preposterous and ludicrous solemnization of sex has been going on almost since my life began. Nothing is more needed on this subject at the moment than a good outbreak of belly laughter. One author tells us that Venus should recur through the married life in a solemn sacramental rhythm. A pupil tells me that a novel, which I had damned as pornography, couldn't really be pornographic because it treated the whole matter so seriously, as if a long face were some kind of disinfectant. The technicians, so to call them, have so bedeviled us with the immense psychological importance of getting this act right and the all but impossibility of doing so, that one imagines some young couples now go to it with the complete works of Freud, Kraft, Ebbing, Dr. Stopes and Havelock Ellis, laid out on bed tables all round them. Then there's D.H. Lawrence, too, and the whole Pillar of Blood school. We're threatened with something like a revival of the phallic religion. But we must not be totally serious on this subject. Indeed, we can't be totally serious without doing violence to our humanity. It's not for nothing that every language and literature in the world at every period is full of jokes about sex. Many of them may be dull or disgusting. Nearly all of them are past their first youth. They may sometimes be an occasion of sin, though not so often, I believe, as people have thought. But we must insist. They express an attitude to Venus which, in the long run, endangers the Christian life far less than one of reverential seriousness. Love ceases to be a demon only when he ceases to be a god. We must not attempt to find the absolute in the flesh. Banish play and laughter from the bed of love, and you have let in a pagan gravity. The mass of the people are perfectly right when they insist that Venus is a partly comic spirit. Venus herself will take her revenge if we accept her occasional claims to total seriousness. Venus herself, a mocking spirit, far more elf than goddess, makes game of us. Where all external circumstances are fittest for her service, she will leave one or both the lovers totally indisposed. Where every overt act is impossible and even glances cannot be interchanged, in crowded shops and at interminable parties, she will assail both with all her powers. Then an hour later, when time and place agree, she will have mysteriously withdrawn, perhaps from only one. Oh, what a pother this must raise! What self-pities, resentments, suspicions, wounded vanities, and all the current chatter about frustration in those who have treated her like a serious goddess. Sensible lovers laugh, of course. It's all part of the game. A game of catch-as-catch-can, and the escapes and tumbles and head-on collisions are to be treated as a romp. Only if we so treat them shall we fall soft and lose with good temper and win, when we do win, light-heartedly. There are three views of the body. To some it is a sack of dung, food for worms, a prison, filthy, shameful, never to be thought of except for the purpose of self-humiliation. That, oddly enough, is a common view among ancient pagans. To others it is glorious. By it, rather than by his soul, man is godlike. Nudists, I suppose, think so. Thirdly, we have the view which St. Francis expressed when he called his body Brother Ass. All three may be, I'm not sure, defensible, but St. Francis for my money. Ass is exquisitely right, because no one in his senses could either reverence or hate a donkey. It's a useful, sturdy, lazy, obstinate, lovable, and infuriating animal, deserving now the stick and now a carrot, at once pathetically and absurdly beautiful. So the body. There's no living with it unless one recognizes that part of its function in our lives is to play the role of buffoon. And, of course, every man, woman, and child in the world does recognize this until some theory has sophisticated them. The fact that we have bodies is the oldest and most universal of all jokes. The error consists in supposing that Eros can or should permanently abolish the joke. That isn't what happens. The conduct and bearing and the very facial expressions of all the sane and happy married couples we know make this quite clear. Lovers, like everyone else, continue to feel an element, not only of play or comedy, but even of buffoonery in the body's expression of Eros. And the body, in this relation as elsewhere, would betray and frustrate us if this ceased to be so. It would be too clumsy an instrument for rendering love's music, unless this very clumsiness could be felt as adding its own grotesque charm. Better plant it foursquare within the drama of Eros as comic relief than pretend it isn't there. But, of course, the poetry is there as well as the unpoetry, the gravity of Venus as well as the levity. But this gravity, which Venus sometimes puts on, is the very reason for preserving also a hint of play in our attitude to her. Natural things are dangerous when they begin to seem too divine. We must understand and distinguish. This is especially true of an attitude which Venus at her gravest calls forth in most, though not all, pairs of lovers. This act may invite the man to an extraordinary though brief dominance as of conqueror or captor, and the woman to a corresponding abjection and surrender. Hence, as in Shakespeare, the lover's pinch which hurts and is desired. How are a sane man and woman to think of this, or a Christian man and woman to permit it? The answer, as I see it, brings out the difference between friendship and Eros at its extreme. In friendship, a man counts for precisely himself, no less, no more. But in the act of love, we are not merely ourselves. We are representatives also. In this kind of love, it's not an impoverishment, it's an enrichment, to be aware that great natural forces work through us. In us too, all the masculinity and all the femininity in the universe strive to meet. The man does play sky father, and the woman does play earth mother. He does play sun and she earth, he form and she matter. But all sanity and Christendom require that we should give full weight to the word play. A woman who accepted as literally her own this extreme self-surrender would be an idolatress, offering to a man what belongs only to God. And a man would have to be a coxcomb, why, a very turkey coxcomb and a blasphemer, if he arrogated to himself as the mere person he is, the sort of sovereignty to which Venus momentarily raises him. Of course, man can't really wear the crown of the Sky Father, only a replica of it done in tinseled paper. I don't call it so in contempt. Paper crowns have their legitimate, and within the proper context, their serious uses. They are in the long run not much less absurd, if imagination mend them, than all earthly crowns. Thus considered, the act of love may, if we like, be regarded as a sort of pagan sacrament or natural mystery. But I dare not say this without once digressing to guard against any possible danger of confusing it with an incomparably higher mystery. As nature crowns man in that brief action, so the Christian law crowns him in the permanent relationship of marriage, bestowing, or shall I say imposing, a certain headship on him. But this is a very different crown. As there's a danger of taking the natural mystery too seriously, so there's danger of not taking the Christian mystery seriously enough. Writers like Milton speak of the husband's headship with a levity to make the blood run cold. They'd better reread St. Paul. The husband is the head of the wife just in so far as he is to her what Christ is to the church. He is to love her as Christ loved the church, and, read on, and gave himself for her. Isn't it clear that this headship is most fully embodied in that man whose marriage is most like a crucifixion, whose wife receives most and gives least, who is most unworthy and in her own mere nature least lovable? For the church has no beauty except what her bridegroom bestows on her. He doesn't find but must make all her loveliness, and in making her his bride he has infinitely descended. The chrism of this terrifying coronation is to be found not in the joys but in the sorrows of marriage, whether these come by sickness or poverty, by the sufferings and perils of a good wife or the faults of a bad one. It is not the triumphant bridegroom who fully enacts this headship. It is some seedy, careworn elderly husband, inured to unreproachful self-denial, burdened with all duties and denied all rights, finally loving the unlovable and forgiving the unforgivable. Forgiving, not acquiescing in, a King Cophetua who, after a quarter of a century, can still hope that the beggar woman he has married will some day learn to wash behind her ears, as Christ can still see in the soiled and tattered church on earth the bride will one day be without spot or wrinkle. The sternest feminist needn't grudge to my sex the crown offered it, either in the natural or in the Christian mystery. The one is of paper, and the other is of thorns. From Venus, the carnal ingredient within Eros, I now turn to Eros in general, and here I think we'll see the same pattern repeated with great consistency. I've already noticed that Eros does not in the act of love aim at pleasure, just in the same way Eros in general doesn't aim at happiness. We may think he does, but when he's put to the test, it proves otherwise. Everyone knows it's useless to try to separate lovers by proving that a marriage between them would probably be unhappy, not only because they'll disbelieve you, though of course they probably will, but even if they believed, they would still hold on their course. For it's the very mark of Eros that when he is in us, we had rather share unhappiness with the beloved than be happy on any other terms. Even when the impossibility of happiness in marriage with the beloved becomes ineluctably clear, Eros never hesitates to say, better this than parting, better to be miserable with her than happy without her, better our two hearts should break together than mend and be whole apart. If the passion within you doesn't say this, it's not Eros. And here, far more than in the senses, lies his supreme peril and his supreme glory. For Eros, so speaking, must seem to all of us to speak with the voice of a god. This total commitment, this transcendence of self-regard, sounds like a message from the eternal and celestial. And some mistake it, and all who love are tempted to mistake it, for the voice of God himself. But it can't be, for it may urge to evil as well as to good. Nothing shallower than to assume that the love which leads to sin is always somehow qualitatively lower, more animal, or more trivial than what leads to a fruitful and faithful Christian marriage. It may be neither wandering lust nor idle sentiment that draws miserable couples into cruel and treacherous unions and into suicide and murder. It may be Eros himself, heart-rendingly sincere and profound. And whatever he commands us, his voice will still have that divine resonance. And there have been schools of thought which attempted to sanction it and to make out reasons why we should always obey the voice of Eros. The one most likely to be believed in our own day is what may be called Shavian. Shaw himself would have called it metabiological romanticism. According to this view, the voice of Eros is the voice of the élan vital, or life force, the evolutionary appetite. In overwhelming a particular couple, it is seeking parents for the Superman. And it's rightly, on Shaw's view, indifferent both to their personal happiness and to the rules of morality, because something far more important than either, he thinks, the future of our species is at stake. If so, the life force doesn't seem to understand its business very well. Because, of course, the existence or intensity of the Eros between two people doesn't, as far as we can see, furnish any ground for expecting that their offspring will be specially satisfactory, or even that they will have any offspring at all. Two good strains, not two fine lovers, is the recipe for good children. And what was the life force about during the countless generations in which marriage didn't depend on love? Has this bright idea, if it is a bright one, for the improvement of our species only just occurred to it? And anyway, most of the pictures that have been painted of the Superman are so very unattractive that if you believed this theory, you'd be inclined to turn monk in order to avoid the mere risk of begetting him. Neither this theory nor any other kind of erotic transcendentalism can be accepted by a Christian. Even if Eros were the voice of the life force, a Christian could only say, so what? The life force is only a creature and perhaps a fallen one. It would not justify us in obeying Eros unconditionally. But unconditional obedience is just what he seems to demand, divinely indifferent to our self-regard, titanically rebellious to any law of God or man that opposed him. When I wrote long ago about the medieval poets and the strange religion of love which they built up alongside Christianity, I'm afraid I treated this too much as a literary matter. I hadn't noticed how Eros himself, by his very nature, invites this kind of quasi-religious treatment. Of course, moralists have often told us that being in love contained a danger of idolatry. But I think they usually meant that the lovers might idolize one another. I don't myself think that's often the real danger. Lovers, no doubt, may put one another before God, as in every sin we put some finite good before God. And in that sense, we may be said, by a very legitimate metaphor, to commit idolatry whenever we sin at all. The real danger is less that they should make idols of one another than that they should make an idol of Eros himself. I don't mean, of course, that they will build altars or say prayers to him. The idolatry I'm speaking of meets one in the popular misinterpretation of our Lord's words, "Much is forgiven to her because she loved much." In their context, taken with the parable of the two debtors which comes just before, this clearly means that the greatness of her love, agape, for Christ, shows how much has been forgiven to her. But thousands of people take it to mean her sins are forgiven, are forgivable, hardly need forgiveness, because a great passion was their motive. It almost felt that if this were so, they were not really sins. In love's law, we lovers have our own law or religion, separate from God's law. Where a true eros, not mere appetite, is present, resistance to any of his commands is felt like apostasy. Temptations speak with the voice of duties, quasi-religious duties, acts of pious zeal. For he builds up his own religion round the lovers. Now they feel they are under his new law, under what in this religion corresponds to grace. They feel they are new creatures. His mere spirit supersedes all laws. These temptations, disguised as a sort of zeal or a sort of piety, needn't, of course, be temptations to unchastity. They are quite as likely to be temptations to act unfairly or uncharitably towards the outer world. It is for love of you that I have neglected my father, for love of you that I cheated my partner. And all the time we have the tormenting paradox that this quasi-god, this Eros whose voice sounds like the eternal, isn't eternal at all. He's notoriously the most desperately mortal of our passions. The whole world rings with complaints of his fickleness. What is puzzling here is not just the fickleness itself. What's really baffling is the combination of this fickleness with his violent assertions that he will be permanent. To be in love is both to intend and to promise eternal constancy. Love makes vows without being asked. "I will be ever true" are the first words he utters. Now, appetites don't speak with that voice. The man who is moved to overeat or overdrink doesn't at all necessarily resolve on lifelong gluttony or drunkenness. If anything, he's far more likely to assure himself that this is the very last time he will indulge in either. He reaches out his hand for the decanter in order to fortify with one more glass his resolution to become a teetotaler. Far more like the love situation is that of the amorist, no mere sensualist, still less a cynic, who has a new so-called wife or mistress, or at least a new affair, every time we meet him, and is quite certain that this time it's the real thing. His wanderings are over, he's found his true love at last, and to her he will be true to death. The closest parallel to the behaviour of Eros is to be found not in our ordinary appetites, but in what may, perhaps, for convenience, be called the intellectual passion. Beside the amorist set the faddist, you know, every time you meet him he has at last found the key to the riddle of the universe. It has been Marx, Freud, Jung, Theosophy, Yoga and Dianetics. Christianity is often given its term. At each time he feels the same certainty. The resemblance is not accidental, and it doesn't, as we might hastily suppose, redound wholly to the discredit of Eros. The passion of the faddist is in a very disordered condition, but it is not a contemptible passion. A brutal and sordid man wouldn't keep on thinking he had found a coherent system of truth. If it were offered him on a plate, he wouldn't care tuppence about it. He'd rather have a drink or a draw on a sweepstake or a new car. The thirst for truth, which the faddist keeps on thinking he has finally slaked, is something men ought to have. He is neither culpable for feeling nor deceived in thinking it of immense value. So with the amorist. But both trust the passion itself, and a very early phase of it, to do for them what no passion can do. A passion can only move us, only supply incentive and energy. It is merely the dive that gets us into the water. Once in, swimming, not diving, is the thing. The faddist's delight in the discovery of, as he thinks, truth, is to be admired, not mocked. The trouble is that he expects the possession and use of truth to be exactly like the discovery. If after his dive he used his muscles and swam, his history would be quite different. The amorist similarly expects being in love to be exactly like falling in love. When the delicious falling is over, when the dive's got him into the water, he doesn't know how to go on. He has enjoyed the incentive of the passion. He never discovers what it is an incentive to, so he presently climbs out and tries a dive in a different pond. For love by itself will not keep us in love, or not for very long. Falling in love is something that happens to us, Being in love, still more remaining permanently in love, is something we do. No passion is self-preservative. The promise of permanence which Eros makes can be kept, but it isn't Eros of himself who can keep it. Yet the transcendental quality in his voice, our feeling when in love that this condition should and must be everlasting, is not wholly a deception. What it really signifies is the immense value, and in its possible developments, the really otherworldly and spiritual value of the change which falling in love works upon us. In a moment it has made appetite itself altruistic, tossed personal happiness aside as a triviality, and planted the interests of another in the centre of our own being. At one bound it has overleaped the high wall of our selfhood. We find ourselves, as regards one other person, really fulfilling the law, really loving another as ourselves. But having done this, the mere feeling will do no more. Eros has now done his stuff. He will not extend this selflessness to others besides the beloved. He may do quite the opposite. He will not even perpetuate it towards her. He will not of himself, even in that relationship, remain the sort of love he promised to be. He may not remain any sort of love at all. He may simply die. For, of course, as we all really know, mere spontaneous feeling will not keep any pair in love even for a few months or weeks. The passion in its total and selfless commitment is intermittent, recurrent. The old self soon turns out not to be so dead as it seemed, as often after a religious conversion. In both, the old self may for the moment be knocked flat, but he will soon be up again, if not on his feet, at least on his elbow, if not roaring, at least back to his old surly grumbling or mendicant whine. The corruptions return. Venus will sometimes slip back into mere sexuality. What's 10 times worse, that desire for the beloved herself, for total unity, may take on a morbid form. It may come to be a sort of imperialism, a desire for absorbing without being absorbed, possessing without being possessed, making the beloved, every thought, wish, and interest, a mere reflection of oneself. And since the beloved may often have exactly the same program for you, success, which would be infamous if achieved, is not very probable. At this stage, the couple are almost fortunate if they fall out of love altogether, but they may remain in it, in that sort of love which is increasingly a sort of hatred. One thinks of Anna Karenina and Vronsky in the novel, jealous, exacting, and resentful. The old amorous exaggeration, "I could eat you," now takes on a new and horrible meaning. My point isn't that these dangers can't be averted. They are averted daily by thousands of couples, but they're not averted by Eros himself. The lovers who idolized him, who trusted all to the strength of their original emotion, will fare the worst. If love is to remain, and to remain himself, he must be supported by outside help. And this everyone knows. Ah, you need a bit of common sense, they say, or some give and take, or a sense of humour. Yes, but in clearer language, you need a firm will to justice. You need a will already pretty well trained and disciplined. In the long run, you need the grace of God. And in this, Eros is like all the natural loves. They have not within themselves resources to secure their own permanence, or to keep themselves from internal corruptions, nor to be innocent in dealing with those outside the circle of love. To say that they all need correction by higher powers in us, and by a power higher than we, though true, is not perhaps the best way of putting it. This suggests that it is always, as it is sometimes, our duty to renounce or diminish them. I should rather say they need the help of higher powers in order to become and remain themselves. The more we trust them to be self-sufficing, self-corrective, and self-perpetuating, the more deceived we shall be. It's rather like a garden. A garden is a glorious thing full of life and giving us life. But you must not trust your garden to weed itself, or fence itself, or prune itself, or anything of that sort. It hasn't got that kind of goodness. A garden left to nature will soon not be a garden. It's the same with our passions. They also are life-giving. But when God planted that garden of our passions, he set a man over it to dress it, and set the man under himself.
The addresses in this series have been copyrighted, and all rights of printing, duplicating on tape, or any other means are strictly reserved.